I don't think that it is that difficult to specialize in more than one asset class. And I think that when you don't subject yourself to specializing in one asset class, it enables you to really have a much more robust deal pipeline that allows you to source many more opportunities and therefore deploy more capital.
Welcome to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate Show. Whether you are an active or passive investor, we'll teach you how to scale your real estate investing business into something big.
Ben Spiegel is an experienced portfolio manager that specializes in niche lower middle market commercial real estate opportunities. Ben, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
Absolutely, Ben. There are three questions I ask every guest who comes to the show. In 90 seconds or less, can you tell me, where did you start, where are you now, and how did you get there?
Yeah, so I started on the investment banking side of things at Barclays. I quickly moved to the buy side, working at several special situations hedge funds, investing in distressed and stress special situations, bankruptcies and restructurings. I was there for about 4 or 5, 6, 7 years. And then when I started working at those firms, I was smart enough to start taking half my bonus and buying real estate with it. And after being on the buy side for about 6 or 7 years, I was presented with an opportunity to buy a large non-performing loan. And take it through bankruptcy and restructure it. And when I did that, I decided to leave the buy side. And that's when I started Redwood Capital, which is a boutique real estate private equity syndication firm. So I have about 75 million under management right now. Fluctuates up and down. I invest really, I like to call myself asset agnostic in that I invest in everything from medical offices to luxury RV resorts to multifamily. I don't really have a preference. As long as it has cash flow and I can understand the drivers of it, I will invest in it. And basically, where do I want to be? I want to be 5, 10 years from now. I want to have 1,500 to 2,000 pads under management or under my ownership in a private REIT that I'm currently forming right now, and to be a premier outdoor hospitality brand similar to a Marriott or a Hilton, but of an outdoor hospitality style.
Man, that's really cool. I love that. You mentioned a lot of different asset classes there. Are you guys coming in just on the capital side on those, or are you actually operating the deals yourself?
No, we're operators as well. We have in-house property management, and actually, I just actually was talking to somebody about this the other day. I think that's really one of the most important and overlooked things in this business. I said that in real estate, if an asset's managed by a third party, it really will never reach its full potential. Because coming from the private equity world, being incentivized and having a sense of ownership is everything. So in every deal I do, I give my property manager, internal property manager, a piece of equity, and I also put them on a quarterly bonus structure that's tiered based on profitability of how the building does in terms of if it clears certain NOI hurdles, they get an incrementally higher bonus. And I have found over the years that had the return on investment for that amount of money has been 10x.
What's that process been like, and how does your team juggle all these different asset classes?
So I guess real estate, compared to corporations where you have FX fluctuations, commodity price fluctuations, it's relatively straightforward. I mean, you have your revenue, your expenses. I mean, there's some obviously variables related to the tenant structure, the longevity of it. But I don't think that it is that difficult to specialize in more than one asset class. And I think that when you don't subject yourself to specializing in one asset class, it enables you to really have a much more robust deal pipeline that allows you to source many more opportunities and therefore deploy more capital.
Interesting. Okay, very, very cool. And the one thing that one focus of yours, and you mentioned this here and kind of what your 5 to 10 year plan is that you are incredibly bullish on the outdoor hospitality space. You want to grow that side of your business. Can you give us some insight as to why?
Yeah. So just to kind of give you some quick four facts that not a lot of people are really aware of. But the right now, the average age of an RV owner in the US is 32 years old.
Right.
Last year, in 2022, 460,000 new RVs were shipped, but only 17,000 new pads were built. The average age of the existing RV destination is over 40 years old, and 92% of which are owned by single owner mom and pop that do not have the necessary resources to invest back into their businesses to bring their destinations up to the level that the new generation of RV owner needs, such as even most don't even offer Wi-Fi or cell service on their sites, to kind of give you an idea of how behind the industry is. And what really makes things exciting is COVID just changed everything. Post-COVID, 60% of permanent office worker or office workers are now permanently remote. So you have this whole new lifestyle, this new nomadic lifestyle that's being embraced, and it's really catapulted the industry into a stratosphere that nobody really thought it could ever go.
Buddy, and you're specifically focusing though on the luxury outdoor hospitality spaces. What does that mean and why is that?
Yeah, so luxury in terms of outdoor hospitality, me, is more of an amenity focus. That it's luxury is it's certainly a lower bar than you would think of when compared to most other asset classes. Luxury basically means you keep a clean site, you have a pool, you have a pickleball court, a gym, maybe a gym. We have gyms, and we like to incorporate a work center, maybe depending on the location. But there's two different really main kinds of RV destinations. You have communities and resorts. So resorts are located very close to a major attraction, close to Disney World, or they're right on the beach. And they're able to charge a higher average ADR, average daily rate. But the downside with them is you have a lot higher turnover. Your average stay is 3 to 5 days max. So there's a lot of turnover, much larger vacancy rate, as opposed to a community where you're probably located still in a very convenient location right off the highway, but probably about 30 or 40 minutes away from like the beach. Like, so I only focus on the Gulf Coast, more specifically Alabama, Mississippi, and Louisiana. And so we're about we a community would be about 30 to 40 minutes from the actual coast, right off a high, a main highway. It'd still have not as many amenities as a resort, but close to it. But the main difference is your average stay is 45 to 60 days, and you also need less staff to run it. So you're basically your net operating margins are about 60% compared to about 45 to 50 for a resort. And instead of operating at like a 30% vacancy or 30% vacancy, you're probably closer to an 18 or 20% for a community. So they complement each other well.
Got it. Okay, that's really interesting. And I guess how many of these do you own currently? And has your model evolved as you have bought different resorts over time?
Yes, so when I first started to get into looking at getting interested in the business, it was during COVID. And at that time, existing RV destinations were trading at all-time high valuations. I mean, I'm
Right.
talking three or four caps for some of these, and that were 40
Wow.
years, where that were like 30 or 40 years old. And what it really occurred to me is I could build at a cost per pad brand new at almost a similar cost, if not less, than what I would have to pay for a 30 or 40 year old one. So that got me on the path to starting a joint venture with a existing owner operator of RV destinations who's also a feasibility consultant. And basically we formed a joint venture, and we went off to start building luxury RV resorts and communities in Mobile, Alabama, Biloxi, Mississippi, and even Gulfport. And so now we have two sites combined, probably 172 pads. And but we have land under contract to build 300 pads right now, which is by far the largest development we've ever done. And something, really interesting about this industry that kind of even makes this whole dynamic even feasible that not a lot of people are aware about is the U.S. Department of Agriculture has a very unique niche loan program called the Rural Business Development Loan Program, where they will lend 75 to 80% loan to construction cost to build an RV destination. I mean, think about it. So you're paying, like, we're in contract on a piece of land for $1.5 million, 40 acres, so, about 35,000 an acre, and our construction budget's 15 million. What kind of lender in their right mind is going to lend you $15 million on a $1.5 million piece of collateral? No. So it's just without this program, it's just it's not, unless you're a family office with, so much cash that you can afford to fund the whole thing with cash and then refinance once you season the cash flow after. The USDA loan credit program is critical to being able to build these in most locations.
Yeah, that's crazy. I knew that the USDA had programs like this. I've not ever applied and/or actually worked my way through that process, especially not on a luxury RV destination project. But that's crazy. Yeah, that's crazy loan terms. I mean, does it ever is there any, I guess, any concern as you look at that and you go, oh my gosh, like we're almost over leveraging, and/or this is like, I don't know. I guess when you think about that, what are some areas of concern? Because this allows you to do things that maybe otherwise wouldn't make sense, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, I guess one of the scariest things is you have to show one-to-one asset coverage on a full recourse basis. So if something does not work out, they're coming for me. Or yeah, they're coming for us.
Right.
They're coming for everything. So you have to have a lot of faith in the project you're building. One thing I'd say is that we never really go above the 75% LTC level, and we have enough experience with our general contractor at this point that we know how the process goes. We know what to expect. We know what the costs are. We're comfortable with the banks that we deal with that are subsequently secured by the USDA. I mean, how it works is it's a 12-month draw schedule. You draw once every for 12, and then upon completion, it immediately converts to a 25-year amortizing facility. So there's like no refinance. It's a lot simpler than you think. As long
Right.
as you can keep construction, and the thing that there's no vertical construction. I mean, the only vertical structure you're doing maybe is a single-story clubhouse. You're just dredging. You're laying plumbing, electric, fiber. Maybe doing some site work, land moving, but that's really about it. It's not high risk. You're not building a skyscraper. I mean, in my experience, I've done ground up developments in multi or in other areas, and usually the problems don't start till you start going vertical. And
Right.
so the fact that you don't really have to do any vertical, I mean, not only is your construction time cut by 75%, it's a year versus four. But it's just, that's honestly the big kicker that makes you comfortable with it. If I would not take on those kind of recourse terms to build a regular multifamily building, that's for sure.
Right. Yeah, there are certainly strings attached there. And I guess that when that 12 months is up, that's when that loan sets to a fully amortized fixed interest rate 25 year loan. So you don't really know in the end, I guess you're underwriting a range. You're like, hey, you know, it could land here, it could land there on your final fixed interest rate.
So basically, it's usually a between a 25 and 50 basis point spread above the Wall Street prime rate, which right now is about 7.75%.
Right.
So it's not very cheap, but it's not insanely. It's not like normally you'd have to go to a bridge lender and you'd be paying 13, 14% and 3 points up front, and you'd only be getting 40% LTV if you're lucky, even full
Right.
recourse. And then the cash on cash returns just do not make sense. So how are you
Right.
going to syndicate a deal like that? The deal, you know, only really makes sense with these loans. Or and, but and then this on smaller destinations, like I'm going into contract on 10 acres on the beach in Long Beach, Mississippi, which is right down from Gulfport, west of Gulfport. And it's going to be about 120 pads, and the development budget there is about like 6 million. There you can get a local bank to get you 65, 70%. It's recourse, but at relatively similar borrowing rate. So you want to be very selective. And also the USDA has a max. Once you go above 25, you can't have more than 25 million outstanding at one time. So once you hit that $25 million mark, you kind of have to start to try alternative sources, whether that's talking to a life insurance company, going to other private areas to borrow money once you have proof of concept, track record. But they do have that $25 million threshold. But then there's ways around it to mix in some SBA or 507s in there to kind of dilute it a little bit. There's ways to get around it, but you want to be very careful. It's not something you want to just take on very lightly.
No, certainly not. And that makes sense. And I think the other thing to point out here is I bet there's probably some multifamily investors who are listening to this right now, and they're like, wait, 7.5 or 7.75 plus 50 basis points, and now you're at 8.25%. And they're going, oh my gosh, that's unsustainable. But the margins inside of the outdoor hospitality space, I just want to point out, are probably a lot more robust, maybe, than what you would find in a multifamily project.
Oh, absolutely. And you also have to understand from an expense ratio standpoint, the taxes down there are nothing. And the reason why you're in that space is you just own the land. You don't have any repairs and maintenance. Something
Right.
breaks in the RV, it's not your dime. If anything, you sign an exclusivity agreement with a repair company and you take a piece of all the money that they make repairing them.
Right,
So
right.
that's it's there's multiple ways to generate incremental income, and it is very sustainable at those rates. If you
Man.
were able, we're, I mean, we're throwing off, I don't know if you're throwing off, mid to high teens levered free cash flow yields, and we target a 4 to 5 year over a 4 to 5 year hold period LP equity multiple between 2.1 and 2.3x.
Right. Oh, that's really cool. I love that. Last question for you here, Ben, before we sign off on this. How do you go about determining what a good location is to build an RV park or luxury RV park ground up?
Absolutely. So there's a few items on the checklist that you always have to abide by. One, you have to be very close to a major interstate. I mean, within maximum of 1 to 2 miles. And that interstate has to be seeing at least a traffic count of 50,000 vehicles per day, 50,000 plus vehicles per day.
Sure.
Number two, you need to be within 10 miles of a Walmart. That's not an industry standard. That's my own or personal underwriting. I just feel that Walmart has the most advanced population analytic software in the real estate industry, and they're not building a super center in an area where the population is going to be declining. Let alone, it's definitely going to be steady, if not growing. Also,
Right.
I only choose to build along the Gulf Coast in the Southeast, where they're experiencing a huge migration rush in terms of population and wealth. They have an abundance of water and electricity, two things that are a lot of areas of the country don't have. You can't build a factory now in most areas of the country because they don't have enough water. You want to see the population growing at a certain clip. You want to pay attention to RV permits, what's going on, how much they're rising by. And you want to be in a good school district, and you want to be on a, you want to have some frontage to a main road as well.
That's
And
fantastic.
then on top of that, you pay a consultant a lot of money to do a robust feasibility analysis to give you an 80-page report just to back all that up.
Right. So you take all the data you have, and then you also pay somebody a whole bunch of money. I love it. Ben Spiegel, thank you for taking the time to come on the show today. I've learned so much from you. I love what you're doing in the outdoor hospitality space. There's not many people who have the courage and the requisite skill set to go out and build new RV parks from the ground up. Especially not luxury ones. So I love it, man. Thank you for taking the
If I can do it, anyone can do it.
time. I doubt that's true, but I certainly appreciate the humility. If our listeners want to get in touch with you or learn more about you, what is the best way to do that?
Yeah, absolutely. RedwoodCapitalAdvisors.com website. Have Calendly, book a call with me. I'm on LinkedIn. Instagram handle is Redwood Capital ADV. I'm always happy to chat about anything real estate related.
Fantastic. Ben Spiegel, thank you again for coming on the show today. I certainly appreciate it. Have a great rest of your day.
Thank you so much, Sam. Thanks so much for having me.
Hey, thanks for listening to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate podcast. If you can do me a favor and subscribe and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, whatever platform it is you use to listen, if you can do that for us, that would be a fantastic help to the show. It helps us both attract new listeners as well as rank higher on those directories. So appreciate you listening. Thanks so much, and hope to catch you on the next episode.